and welcome to the Raptors Show on SportsCenter on 90 The Fan. I'm your host, Mike Wu. I am joined, as always, on Tuesdays by the Fan Morning Show's Blake Murphy. Blake, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing well. Blake, how does it feel to be extremely famous? I mean, obviously, you're already quite famous, but fresh off your most recent appearance on The Low Post.
It was fun. I had a big head for like 7 minutes and then like eight replies to Zach's tweet. Yo, get Will Lou on. Get Will Lou on. You're the one who's big time, man. You're so big time that when other people make it big time, people are like, nah, man.
Yeah, that's I have to apologize for the hive, but I really can't apologize. Unfortunately, no, you did great on The Low Post. And obviously, Zach, you know, in terms of all the mainstream U.S.-based, like, you know, reporters, basketball reporters, I think Zach obviously has a connection here to the city through his wife. And he just, you know, has consistently shown a lot of interest and a lot of love in the Raptors. And obviously, for people who don't know, he has an annual thing around Christmas or around the New Year, that time, where he talks to Eric Kareen, who has been on for probably like 6-7 years running, and then Bruce Arthur. But you've taken Bruce's spot. So how does it feel?
Apparently.
How does it feel?
It feels, anytime you can take Bruce down a peg, it's a great thing. But no, Bruce is basically a full-time public health reporter at this point. So I appreciate the nod. And it's good timing, I think, because obviously normally he'd do this over the holidays. So we would have been a couple weeks ago, and it would have been right in the middle of that huge COVID outbreak where the Raptors were playing Tremont Waters and Daniel Oturu big minutes. And instead, like, the Raptors are one of the more interesting teams in the league right now. Win six straight and get an actual test against a not fully equipped team, but a reasonably equipped team tonight.
Yeah, and I'll be looking forward to seeing that. And that's actually what I want to talk to you about, is sort of sorting out what's real and what isn't real during this game win streak here by the Raptors. I was listening to the practice interviews from team practice yesterday by the Raptors, and Nick Nurse was talking about, look, we haven't really played perfectly, and there's still a long way to go with this team. And I think that especially when you look at how hairy that Jazz game was at times, and then honestly that Pelicans game, the fact that the Raptors built four separate double-digit leads but then blew them all and then had to sort of really clinch it at the very end, like, these haven't been the most seamless performances by any means. But, you know, before we get to some of these stats that I'll sort of walk through with you and sort of see if they're real or not, do you have a most impressive win between the six here by the Raptors and maybe the least impressive one?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, the most impressive win, look, Milwaukee, even without Giannis, is still a hard team to beat. Like, they had Drew and Chris Middleton for that game. I think it's probably how easily they handled the Knicks. You know, and again, the Knicks were shorthanded, but like, you can't go through this six-game streak, and you could even go back further than that. Like, a couple of the wins they racked up before Christmas were against, like, the Kings and the shorthanded Warriors and stuff. So every team is dealing with this right now. But I thought, you know, that Knicks game, it finished a 15-point game. That was a 20-point game for most of the second half. That was a game, you know, RJ was about it, right? And Fournier gets a couple shots off, and Obi Toppin is whatever. But the Raptors were pretty much in control, it felt like. And I thought that was the game where it started to look maybe the most like what this team wants to look like offensively. And what I mean by that is Fred led the way in scoring, but he was off the ball a lot. Pascal had the ball in his hands more than Fred did, I think, initiating sets there. And I think that they've just kind of kept that rolling since then. In terms of least impressive, you know, they won that Jazz game by 14 and they ended up covering. But you can't give up 40 points in a quarter to Eric Pascal, Elijah Hughes, and Jared Butler. Like, you just can't do that. You just can't. And I know that I keep saying Pascal instead of Pascal, but obviously that the reason why is obvious, because Pascal Siakam, and he played like Pascal Siakam in that game, especially in the first quarter. So I think that Utah game is probably the worst one of those. And like, you can forgive the Milwaukee first quarter a little bit more because they had Drew and Middleton and they got really hot on threes, but that Utah team had no business scoring 40 points in a half.
They did not. So, I mean, I think that's the whole point, right? Like, you know, they've had these imperfect quarters, imperfect stretches, even the Bucks game, which was very fun and really impressive. The Raptors had a 29-point turnaround to go from being down 14 to being up 15. They held the Bucks only 11 points in that third quarter. They gave up 77 points in the first half, right? So I actually do agree with you. The Knicks game or even the Spurs game, those games were the ones that were most impressive to me because of how comprehensive the effort was sort of from start to finish and how they looked. So let's get into some of these trends over the six-game win streak. So the trend number one is that the Raptors are second in offensive rating at 119.0 during this six-game win streak. It's interesting when you dig into the numbers. It's not like the Raptors are shooting the lights out. Obviously, Fred is shooting the lights out, but they're only 10th in three-point percentage during this time. They're 13th in true shooting percentage. Now, the things that are actually propping up the offensive rating are things like second in offensive rebounding percentage. They continue to really get a huge share of the rebounds and on their own misses. And also, they're third in free throw attempts per game at 27 attempts per game, which is why my tweets have dropped significantly on the timeline, because the Raptors are actually getting the respect they deserve. But yeah, okay, so do you see, they're probably not going to be the second best offensive team all season, but is there something sustainable from this stretch offensively that you like to see them potentially carry forward when they're, you know, no longer just playing, let's say, like banged up opponents or whatever?
Yeah, I think, you know, the free throw attempts is the most interesting one to me, because that's the thing that they've traditionally not done a great job of. And that's kind of been true since Kawhi left. Like, they're just not a high free throw offense. And even with this recent surge, they're still 25th in the league in free throw rate. So, you know, I don't think you control, like, if you're the Raptors, your personnel's set. You don't control a ton what your three-point percentage is going to look like and what your even your effective field goal percentage to a degree. So you and I have talked a lot this season about, okay, well, they got to win the possession battle, which means not turning the ball over, hitting the glass hard, and forcing a lot of turnovers at the other end. And those are boxes they've checked. If they can also add some freebies via the free throw, and that to me, I think that indicates, hey, you're putting better pressure on the rim. You're getting 2 feet in the paint, because that tends to be where you get those free throw attempts from, not on spot up jumpers. I think that's a good sign. I think, you know, this is kind of a good thing and a bad thing, I guess. But you look at this last six games, and yes, they've jumped that high in offense. They're still only 19th in the league in half court offense during that stretch. So the half court offense has been a little bit better, but still not even league average. And why I say that's good and that's bad is, the bad side is you're probably not going to grab 34-35% of your misses all the time, and those free throws might dry up, and you'd like to see the half court offense clicking a little bit more. But I think the other side of that is that, hey, we're almost halfway into the season, and this is a borderline top 10 offense despite the half court offense not being very effective yet. So if you want to give some runway to them to figure it out more, if you think now that they're healthy and now that they're figuring out roles and stuff like that, that the half court offense can improve, I think the transition game and the second chances have provided a pretty nice offensive floor for them to build off of from here.
Yeah. And you know what, in a different setting, let's say the Raptors were a winning franchise. Well, I mean, right now they're a winning franchise, but like if they were consistently a playoff team, like in years past, and they had sort of these sort of this profile in offense, I'd be more worried, just because I do feel like some of these things start to dry off in the playoffs. There's obviously just less pace overall in the playoffs, or at the minimum that there's just less blatant kind of laziness in transition in a lot of these times, just because the games are more intense. Maybe your offensive rebounding holds up, maybe it doesn't. But right now, at least for the Raptors, my main concern isn't how well this team can do in the playoffs at the moment. My main concern is how well can they play the next game and the next game, and if they can make it to the playoffs and sort of which guys show growth. I think right now, though, yeah, I mean, you know, they've been good offensive rebounding this whole season, as you mentioned. And I think that, you know, that probably plays at least a little bit in terms of the free throws as well. You know, they're really crashing the glass hard. They're playing multiple bigs. I mean, we saw like that the Raptors didn't really outplay the Pelicans over the course of the game. But where they won that game was they had 15 offensive rebounds to only 7 for the Pelicans. And it was real interesting because like the Pelicans start JV in the middle, 17 rebounds for him. He was definitely a factor on the glass, but the Raptors were still able to win the offensive rebounding battle. And I think that's interesting because, you know, for a lot of people, when they see the Raptors start to lose a couple of these, you know, loose balls or some loose possessions or whatever, they're like, oh, the Raptors need a traditional big. They need a traditional big. It's kind of interesting that the Raptors don't have this traditional big, but when they've had their three bigs healthy, they've been able to sort of almost in tandem function like a traditional big would in getting you all these offensive rebounds, getting you all these plays at the rim. And we'll talk about just what's worked in terms of front court pairings a little bit later on. Let's move to stat number two. So the Raptors are only 10th in defensive rating during the six-game win streak at 108.3. Their defensive rebounding has gone up. They're up to 9th in the NBA over the six-game stretch at 74%. Rebounding their own misses, which is really close to average. You know, there's a big range there between about 73 to like 75%. Raptors in the middle of that. The Raptors actually are still allowing a pretty high percentage from opponent three-point shooting. They're 23rd in the stretch, and they're about average in terms of giving up opponent shooting in the paint. So, like, I don't know. To me, that seems to be the part where I think the Raptors can still really improve on defense. And when you look at the Raptors' defensive metrics overall in the season, they're lower than what the Raptors were expected to be coming into this year. So what do you think is behind that right now?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's definitely a little bit of, hey, there are a couple components of defense, right? It's can you get back and get your defense set? Can you turn the other team over? Can you end a possession with a defensive rebound? And the answer to those is yes, yes, and no. Like, the Raptors just don't profile as a good defensive rebounding team. And I do think that there's an important difference between how offensive rebounds are created and how defensive rebounds are secured, where, on the defensive rebounding side, the Raptors do lack a traditional center and a traditional rim protector, which is why they get very aggressive and very switchy and zone up a little bit. And it leaves guys in poor position for defensive reboundings. Whereas on the offensive glass, it doesn't matter so much that you don't have a traditional center because you're really, really big everywhere except point guard and sometimes even at point guard. So you have, you know, maybe you give up a size advantage at the five, but you have a size advantage at 2, 3, 4. And when you're talking about guys, you know, crashing from the corner on their way back in transition defense, that's an easier thing to get out of your length than, hey, you just switched all over the floor and did a really aggressive closeout, and now you've got to crack back. So I don't know that the defensive rebounding is coming along, but the other component of this is, can you stop the other team when they shoot? And the Raptors haven't done that yet, and it's probably the biggest curiosity is they have this really good defensive personnel, at least at the top of their rotation, and it's not the getting stops part that is working out really well. It's the forcing turnovers part. And they are, you know, sending opponents to the free throw line a lot, giving up a bottom five effective field goal percentage. So there's a lot going on there. And I do think, you know, they've ticked upward from, what are they overall, 21st in defense to 10th during this stretch. I think most of that's probably opponent based, but you'd hope that there's a little bit of, hey, the bulk of your top seven or eight in your rotation have been here for a couple games now, and you would hope that there's some familiarity and some communication and connectivity that comes with that. But I really just think that, you know, they haven't played defense as well as they can, and that's reductive, but what did we think this team was going to be? We thought they'd be an average to below average offense and a borderline top 10 defense, and those things have been reversed. So I think there's a lot of room for growth still on the defensive end beyond what we've seen in this six game trip.
So. Yeah. I mean, okay. So I think universally coming into this season, and we did a lot of previews and stuff like that, like, we thought the Raptors were for sure going to be a really good defense and an offense that was going to be, you know, about 20th. It's essentially what we expected was that the Raptors would be the opposite of what they are now, which is roughly like 10th in offense and the 20th in defense. Instead, it's sort of, you know, we thought it would be 20th in offense, 10th in defense. What do you think we've gotten wrong about the defense? Is it the injuries? Is it guys underperforming? Is it just a lack of cohesion? Like, is there one specific thing you can kind of point to?
No, I think, you know, to speak broadly, like, we knew that they were going to be really aggressive, right? That's who they are. That's how they want to use their length. They lead the league in forced turnovers, which helps fuel the transition game, which we just talked about how the half-court offense is shaky, so you need those transition buckets. But there are trade-offs with that aggressive strategy that you can do poorly with or you can do well with. And I think that they've too often been on the poorly side. And that's, again, hacking teams and sending the line a lot, giving up the defensive rebounds. And then just, you know, there are those instances where, and you could pick out, like pick your guy, pick your game, whatever. Everyone's had a couple where you take a gamble on a wild closeout or jump in a passing lane, and what was a moderately contested shot, if you were defending conservatively, becomes an open shot. And those are the things that, you know, in Nick Nurse language, he'd probably say, okay, if that happens 12 times a game, we want to get it down to 10 times a game. And ideally, it's only happening 8 times a game, you know, to do his thing about the young guys who need to perform twice every 5 games, then 3 times every 5 games, etc. So I think they just like to get that number down, and it's not coming down yet. There's still, you know, Gary Trent's a good example, and I don't want to pick on him too much because he's been so much better this year defensively. But we've seen over the last little while, like, those gambles have stopped being quite as successful. And because he's has a reputation now for taking them, you see teams, you know, pick on him a little bit in semi-transition. Or, I think ideally Svi's not in the rotation, but there's a reason that he ends up guarding the ball handler way more than you would expect for a defender of his caliber, and it's that opponents are picking on him. So, you know, there are going to be a couple spots like that. Like, you're not the championship year Raptors. You can't have zero bad defenders in your rotation, but you can minimize that impact. And I think, you know, I think we'll see. Pascal's been better defensively of late. OG's in and out of the lineup has maybe taken some of the edge off of his defensive ceiling so far this year. And then Scotty Barnes is just, he's a rookie, right? So you're going to have ups and downs. So I think this is all stuff that I would expect to be better in the second half of the season. But right now it's just a lot of, like, they look like a young and less experienced team on defense.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think that's probably the one part that we kind of overlooked, maybe collectively, when we kind of get so enamored with, oh, everybody's 6'9" and has a 7-foot wingspan except for Fred, who, you know, who's somehow the best defender of that group anyway. We just kind of see that on paper and we're like, this is gonna work. But I think a lot of it is that inexperience, and it is a tough defense to sort of pick up for the guys, and of course injuries have not helped. But I do think that I agree with you there. The defensive talent is still such that they should perform better, especially when they've gotten a couple of guys back healthy, playing consistently. The rotations look better of late just in the eye test. But I still think there's a lot of room to improve. I think in terms of what Nick wants them to do, that's what he's mostly talking about. Nick is always worried about the defense. The offense will kind of figure itself out. And right now, my trend number three is the offense is figuring itself out because Fred is averaging 31 points per game during this 6-game win streak. As Alex outlined on Monday's episode, his numbers are essentially Steph Curry's numbers from last year over the last 6 games. When you're looking at 5.8 threes made per game, shooting 44%, he's shooting 47% overall from the field. He's getting to the free throw line and shooting 90% from there, about 7 assists per game in 36 minutes. He just won player of the week for the Eastern Conference. That was his first of his career, rightfully so. I mean, we know Fred's not going to average like Steph Curry numbers all season.
Do we?
But is there? I mean, come on, Blake. Come on. You see some of the shots he's making? I feel like he's probably the one guy.
We have 9 games left for the All-Star propaganda. These next 9 games, if we have to say Fred VanVleet is Steph Curry, we can do that, I think.
No, but his numbers are literally like on that level right now, which is crazy. Kind of absurd.
Even his numbers for the season. So JD, my co-host, JD and Ailish, my co-host on the Fan Morning Show this morning, asked me, like, how does Fred's season so far compare to, like, the best Kyle seasons? And I dug into the numbers, and it's like, okay, his usage is up. His efficiency is up to, like, way above career high levels in terms of true shooting percentage. His assist rate is at a career high. His rebounding rate's up. His steal rate is still where we expect it. There's not, his finishing's better, his 3-point shot's better. There is nothing that Fred's not doing better. And then you dig into the impact metrics and stuff like that and the on-offs. This would probably be Kyle's 3rd or 4th best season, which is crazy.
That's absurd.
Because Kyle has like 7 of the 10 or 12 best seasons in franchise history. So it's that, like, maybe he's not Steph Curry, but like he's a moderate Kyle Lowry season so far this year.
Yeah, it's pretty absurd what Fred is doing. It's also really absurd just thinking about this and how, yeah, Fred's doing so well, but Kyle's had many seasons better than this, which is also just outrageous. Obviously, the Raptors have been spoiled at the point guard position between these two guys. Okay, so the one thing that stands out to me over this specific six-game stretch, he's shooting 22 shots per game at 47% shooting. Clearly, you want to get the ball to Fred at this point. You know, he's the hot hand. You got to keep feeding him. It's actually been interesting. So they moved him more off the ball, but he's shooting more often. Is that just the team is doing a really good job of, you know, executing plays and getting him coming off screens or driving and kicking and finding him? Or, you know, what is that? Because that's not what you would normally expect. If you cut a guy off the ball, he's probably not going to be shooting as much. But what we've seen here over the six-game win streak, 23 shot attempts in the win over the Spurs, 27 attempts against the Clippers, 22 against the Jazz, and then 27 against the Pelicans. So that's four games right there where he's had more than 20 shots. And the other games are 17 and 18, which is about a season average. So the shot distribution is pretty wild, you know?
Yeah, it is. And, like, you know, you don't expect Fred VanVleet to have a 28, 29% usage rate over any stretch of games, really. And I think, you know, you dig into those numbers and what does that mean? That he's taking that many shots, even though the ball's in his hand a little bit less. And it means that the ball's in the hands of other players, obviously. So I think that as much as Fred deserves a great deal of credit and he's shot the lights out, this isn't possible to this extent if Pascal Siakam and to a lesser extent Scottie Barnes and OG Anunoby aren't capably taking on some extra ball handling duty, because during this win streak, Delano Banton has played garbage time. Malachi Flynn has played garbage time, and that's it. There are no other, like, no second point guard is getting minutes. So whether it's when the 12 minutes a game Fred's on the bench or the, you know, every second possession or whatever, however you want to split it up, when he's on the court and you want him off the ball, you know, this doesn't flow quite as well without Siakam being so good as kind of a lead handler and a distributor. And I think, you know, it's not as, like, cut and dry as that. Like, Fred's still the point guard when things come down and it's in the half court. Whereas Pascal's more, hey, in transition, he's going to pull the defense low and then Fred's going to trail and he's either going to have a shot or they'll get into some pistol or whatever. But Pascal's averaging 6.5 assists over his last seven. And I think that that's a huge component of this, because I think, you know, I know Pascal's had the scoring numbers as well. Like, they're combining for 55 points a game during this win streak. And I think a big part of this is that it's not just Fred being hot and it's not just Pascal taking a step as a passer. It's that these two work really well together and they have a good chemistry. And now that both of them are clicking, you kind of see how they make the game easier for each other. It's not, you know, they're not similar player types necessarily, and structurally the offense isn't the same, but the dynamic is starting to feel a little Kyle and DeMar-ish, where, you know, they used to, either one of those guys could get you 20 or 25 on a given night, but by the end, DeMar was playing point guard, you know, fairly often alongside Kyle to get Kyle off the ball and to help with spacing. And then, you know, they would talk all the time about, like, oh, this felt like a DeMar night, or this felt like a DeMar quarter, and he had the matchup, so we went there. And I think Fred and Pascal are kind of figuring that out. Part of that is probably this is the first sustained stretch of both of them being completely healthy and playing well in a long time.
Yeah, yeah, and Pascal was going to be my trend number four, especially with the focus on the assists. No, it's all good, man. It's perfect. So the last six games where the Raptors have gone 6-0, Pascal's assist. So he's had 16 assists to Fred and then 21 assists to all the other players on the team combined. He's throwing 37% of his passes to Fred. The next closest in terms of percentage share is 16% for Scotty. He's just force feeding Fred. And why would you not? Because on passes from Pascal Siakam in the last six games, Fred VanVleet is shooting 70% from three. He's 16 of 23 from three off of passes directly from Pascal Siakam in the last six games. And when you watch the games, the eye test tells you, yeah, a lot of these games are like, even the end of the Pelicans game, there's that one possession, you know, late in the game where Pascal is kind of dribbling and there's not really going anywhere. And then Fred's just like putting his hand up at half court. And he's like, yeah, I'm open. I'm open. I'm at half court. I'm open. He kicks it out to him. And then Fred hits a logo three. Like, that, it's outrageous. But I think that's exactly, you know, the trend I was going to point out too, is just it's very DeMar and Kyle-like. And the fact that they're able to trade off right now, it's great. The two-man game, I do wish they can develop more of this two-man game with other guys as well, just because we've seen Pascal be able to lift other players, we've seen Fred be able to lift other players. But right now, just having that core function between the two guys there in the middle of the, in the just the middle of the floor doing their thing, it's providing the foundation for like where the rest of the guys can sort of slot in. And that's something that I want to talk to you, Blake, about on the other side of this break. So I've been your host, Will Liu. You were listening to The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this six-game win streak, talk about the best lineups over the stretch, and get a little bit into maybe what the Raptors will do at the trade deadline. Welcome back to The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 580 The Fan. I continue to be joined by Blake Murphy of The Fan Morning Show, and we continue to discuss the Raptors' six-game win streak and some of the trends that are standing out to the two of us. So I want to get to trend number five, which is the best lineups over the stretch. And when you talk about the best five-man lineups, the two that I've played the most are Scottie Barnes plus the starters. And I'll say the starters in the sense that it's Gary, it's Fred, it's OG, it's Pascal. Scotty plus starters has played 42 minutes. And then the first sub that usually comes in for Scotty is always Cam Birch. And they have played Birch plus the starters is 33 minutes. The interesting thing here is that they're plus 15 in 33 minutes with Cam Birch plus the starters, as compared to just plus one in 42 minutes with Scotty plus starters. And I think that kind of backs up on the eye test. The Raptors haven't really gotten off to the greatest of starts, especially when you look at some of the games against Utah or against, Milwaukee, for example. Defensively, they've just been poor. What do you think? I mean, obviously, this is such a small sample, so there could just be lots of variance in this, just very, very small sample here. But, Blake, what do you think is behind some of this sort of variance in terms of just the fact that they seem to have worked better with Birch in the starting group here?
Yeah, I don't want to, completely undercut the point. I do think a big part of this is they're shooting 32% as a unit with Barnes on the floor and 48% with Birch on the floor. And that's not a Barnes versus Birch thing. You could come to some of it with like, oh, having another quality screener on there or a short roll threat helps a little bit, but some of that is noise. So there's a little bit of noise there. I also just think that if you're looking at floor for certain units, and this is something we've talked about going back to the start of the season when we thought maybe Gary Trent Jr. would come off the bench or Scotty Barnes would come off the bench and Ken Birch would start. And it's because Ken Birch is kind of a perfect guy in terms of, hey, a fifth body that does the little stuff and doesn't need the ball at all. He sets good screens. He's good on the glass at the offensive end. And then he's just kind of steady defensively. He's nothing, he doesn't stand out exceptionally or anything like that, but he's steady there. So I do think that maybe the floor is a little higher when he's on the floor, and then the ceiling gets a little higher with Scotty Barnes, because obviously you have a little bit more transition juice, you have a little bit more switchability, etc. So mostly noise, but also a little bit of just upside versus downside. And Barnes, we're also catching Barnes at a bit of a, if you chopped his season up into five or six game chunks, this has been one of his lesser chunks defensively, I think, too.
Yeah, and I think there's a conversation we had about sort of just Scotty's usage overall, too, not just the defensive end. I think defensively, they're asking him to play five. He's had good moments there. He's had bad moments there. I don't think he's naturally a five, whereas Kem, obviously, is way more experienced, and he's primarily played one position for his NBA career so far. I mean, the interesting here with Kem, though, is that he's not actually doing that much. Like when you look at the box score, like it's not like he's scoring a ton. I think he's averaging about 4 points over the six game win streak, but he does pop up in a lot of these sort of like plus minus metrics. When you look at sort of the commonalities of some of these successful lineups, Birch is, the Raptors have been quite successful with Kem on the floor, which has been kind of interesting. It's something I want to definitely look more into, because I haven't actually noticed him all that much. But he seems to be popping up on the data here. I think the one group that has really impressed me is Boucher plus Precious off the bench. The two-man combo there. playing in the front court. Yes, it looks awkward offensively. They're good for like one or two Shaq in a full plays, like once, like just per game, whether that's like Chris Boucher, like exhausted on the bench, or Precious fumbling on one on fast break. But they've been good. They've been good. And Blake, I wanted to ask you, like, it, beyond sort of just looking at the numbers specifically, what do you think is, like, what kind of advantages do you think playing those two guys off the bench together is giving the Raptors?
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, a lot of opposing bench units don't have a ton of size, right? So we get into this talking about the Raptors as a smaller team because they don't have a traditional center. But most second units also don't have two 6'9", 6'10" bigs who can also, you know, get out and run and be pretty, you know, versatile stylistically. So I do like that Boucher Precious pairing as kind of a chaos front court. I think part of this too, and again, I don't want to be too reductive, but like Chris Boucher is just playing really, really well of late after a long stretch of not playing well to start the year. And sometimes it's that simple, right? It is, hey, the Boucher-Achiuwa pairing is only going to work when those guys are playing well because those two don't have a lot of room for error in their games. And I think one of the most interesting things about Boucher's turnaround is that he hasn't done it with a super high usage rate or commanding a lot of shots. And that's always been the challenge for him, right? Is not only finding where are your shots and where do they come within the larger offense, but how do you affect winning when either your shots aren't there or they're not falling? And I think him having, you know, during this 6-game win streak, he's taken over 7 field goal attempts once, but he's still been, I would say, a positive in probably 5 of those 6 games, you'd say. So I think that's great for him. And Precious is just, you know, he's back on the court regularly. He's healthy. I do think that this defense is, there's probably a decent learning curve if you're playing the center position with how this team attacks. So there's some of that there. And then there's just a bit of regression. Like Precious wasn't going to shoot 12% at the rim forever. You know, maybe that gets up to 18%, 20%. sorry, being too negative. It is still very low, though.
It is quite low. 54%
at the rim, but
it's quite low.
Yeah, so I think that's part of it. I also just think sometimes with a second unit, like, it's as much about identity and knowing how you want to play as anything else. And Boucher and Achiuwa both being told, hey, you're going to run like crazy. You're going to use your length and athleticism and speed relative to your position to kind of fly around on defense and in transition and hit the offensive glass. And you're only going to play in 5 or 6 minute stints because we want you collapsing on the bench like Chris Boucher did. I think that that's good for these guys. I think that more narrowly defined role, and this is part of the benefit of, like, you know, having the top guys back and healthy more regularly is not just about them. It's about guys like Boucher and Precious being in roles that better suit where they're at or better suit their skill sets. So Boucher doesn't have to start and play 28, 29 minutes. He could just maximize those 20 off the bench. So I think there's a lot of, there are a lot of little things pulling in the right direction for those guys as a duo.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that these guys are, they just look so engaged. And I think one thing in terms of just playing bigger in general is that, like, you're going to have these size mismatches that's really going to help you in many ways. But I think especially in transition, when these guys are switched out to the guards and on the perimeter and the play turns over, whether that's on a live ball turnover or that's on a missed shot, the Raptors secure the rebound. All of a sudden, when people are running back the other way, it's guards that are trying to sort of hold up Precious or guards that are trying to hold up Chris. And that's just a very easy way for you to capitalize in transition when you have that automatic mismatch just at the point where the sort of play turns over. And and also their energy is great, as you mentioned. Like, you know, Chris getting exhausted is totally makes sense because in the 66 minutes with Chris and Precious on the floor, they've collected 22 offensive rebounds. They've gotten you 19 steals. Like, and you know, they've blocked a couple
of offensive rebounds.
Yeah, that's a lot of extra possessions, which you're just going to win because we know the bench is not going to score like a ton, right? Even recently, you're still seeing like routinely that other teams will have like a 20-point per game performance off the bench, but the Raptors will have like, I don't know, 5 or 6 from each guy. But it doesn't matter, though, if you do win the possession battle. That is another way to win, and I think that's probably the team strategy overall. So I think Nick has really optimized his lineup, though. Even though it's weird bringing Like, your sixth man is Ken Burch, your seventh man is Chris Boucher, and your eighth man is Precious Achiuwa. They're all centers. You have no centers in the starting group. But it seems to be really working. Is there any sort of specific tweak that you would want to see from the starting or from the regular rotation, or are you kind of happy with what they've settled with here?
I mean, I'm mostly happy with it. The tough one for me is, and I've mentioned this a couple places, and I hope people don't think I'm like bagging on the guy, because every time I've qualified it with, he doesn't quote unquote deserve this, but I'm curious what it would look like with Gary Trent Jr. coming off the bench and Ken Burch starting. And if he were to miss a couple games here with this ankle thing, maybe that's an opportunity to try it for a game and see what it looks like. Now, you can accomplish that differently. You could try having him come out as the first sub as Ken Burch comes in or something like that. But I look at that second unit and what's working for it and where there's a gap between what they're doing now, which has been more successful, and what those units probably look like ideally. And it's finding a different source of those 10 SV minutes in that second unit. And there aren't a lot of guys on this team that have that skill set who can move off the ball. And SV hasn't hit any threes this season, but, you know, a guy who could conceivably hit them. So I would, whether it's starting that way or just tweaking the rotations like that a little bit more, I would like to see Gary Trent kind of in the SV role with the second unit. I just think there's more opportunity to get Cam or Precious with the starters in exchange to kind of balance that out. And I don't think, like, getting Utah back is great, but he's kind of in the mix with the Boucher, Precious, Cam group, not necessarily the SV, Malachi, Banton group that basically at this point aren't getting minutes, I don't think. So they need a little bit of backcourt juice in the second unit still, and maybe how you pattern Gary Trent's minutes can help with that a little bit.
Hmm. Well, I mean, maybe we'll just skip ahead to that conversation then, because, you know, if you're looking at the trade deadline, and Blake, you're going to be on every Tuesday. I'm going to ask you the same question every Tuesday. You know the deal. You do 4 hours of radio in a day anyway. But yeah, I mean, in terms of short-term or long-term moves that the Raptors may look to make at the deadline, in terms of the short-term need, it's got to be the backcourt, especially the bench backcourt. That you just need some more depth. And the Raptors are begging for one more, maybe even two more perimeter creators. And of course, OG can do a little bit of that for you. Gary can do a little bit of that for you. But what you really need is a backup point guard who can run the second unit, and just sort of do a little bit of shooting, do a little bit of playmaking, you know, a Goran Dragic type, but not Goran, unfortunately. So, yeah, how do the Raptors get another? Can they trade Goran for, a version of Goran that isn't completely down bad about Miami?
Yeah, what's Zoran Dragic doing these days?
Oh, that's right.
I definitely think that's the area of need, right? And I think, you know, the way the rotation patterns have gone, they're less enthused with Delano Banton as the season's gone along, which I think is fair. Delano Banton was always a guy that, even when he was playing well, was like, this guy should probably be getting some 905 run to really become the best version of himself. Malachi Flynn, I think they're just out on at this point. Like, he got benched for the entire fourth quarter of a 905 game last night and did not play well in, like, deserved that benching. So,
by the way, just to read you the Malachi Flynn stat line from yesterday, 3 of 12 from the field. And I'm pretty sure one of those was a catch and shoot three. Another two were just pull up mid range jumpers that were contested. Yes, he made those, but those are not the kind of shots that you would expect an NBA quality player to be doing at the G League level. And yeah, bench for the entire fourth quarter, and the Raptors made a comeback in the fourth quarter. So it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough. Anyway.
So yeah. I could see this going a couple ways if you're going to address it. And I think the important thing to keep in mind for the Raptors is that while they're a solid team this year, I don't think they're pulling from future assets, really. Like, I would be very surprised if they put a first round pick in a deal that doesn't bring back like a really notable player, not the type of guy we're talking about here. So the three things that I'd be looking at are, does Dragic return a second or a salary or something like that, that you can reroute elsewhere to address your backup point guard needs? So maybe that expands to a three team deal. The second would be, is there a team willing to buy low on Malachi Flynn either for a pick or for a more veteran point guard who's closer to free agency, because Flynn still has 2.5 years on that rookie scale deal and then RFA. So someone could definitely talk themselves into that being worthwhile, especially because one of the years is an option. So if he doesn't work out, you're not like locked into it. And the third one would be, and this is tough because he's played so well lately and he's been around forever. You don't really want to see him go, but Chris Boucher turns 29 today and is an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season, who I think a lot of teams who are competitive right now could use him as a third or fourth big. And in both conferences, you can find a couple potential trade partners. So, you know, you're bringing three pseudo centers off the bench right now and you have no bench guards, whereas around the league, capable bench bigs are in more demand. So maybe there's a trade there where a Boucher is headed out because he's headed to free agency and you address guard that way in what's purely a basketball trade, right? It's not a being a buyer. It's not a being a seller. It's finding a team that has a strength where you have a weakness and vice versa. So those are the three paths, I think, to that.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I would hesitate specifically, because clearly, like, if you listen to this program all season, at the start of the season, I was very confused by what Chris was doing. Right now, he's been so productive, though, that I'm, like, a little bit hesitant. But, yeah, I agree with you. I think that is probably the move. Honestly, like, if they're looking for a short-term move, I don't even know specifically how much that would interest the Raptors, considering this is the development year. They're probably looking to see which guys can do what in what scenarios. I think for me, if they're going to make a trade to address the backcourt, I would love for them to get in somebody who was younger, maybe less established, but has a potential here to sort of grow into a bigger role, kind of the way they traded Norm for Gary. And, you know, like in that front, obviously there's probably more candidates, because you can probably look around the league and see players who were drafted high, but then haven't really like caught on, or maybe aren't necessarily prioritized. I brought up the name of like a Lonnie Walker IV, kind of that kind of scenario where, you know, the Spurs have already signed DeJounte Murray. They've signed, you know, White. They've drafted Primo. Do they really want to sign a fourth guard to long-term money? You know, I'm not saying that they're out on him or anything like that, but just sort of like looking in that kind of window. And I think, to me, like, it's not even just like this is a short-term need. Like, okay, after this season, the Raptors are going to solve what they have coming off the bench. I think when you come up empty, which is so far what they've come up with in the 2020 NBA draft, between Malachi at 29 and then Harris at what was he, 59, I think. When you come up empty like that in a draft class, when you're looking to address the backcourt, that's how you end up in a situation like this where you don't really have any other options other than Svi off the bench, which that's tough, man. So Svi has a player option?
Yeah, that's it's one of those ones where like the Raptors love throwing around player options, man. Stanley
Why,
Johnson,
bro?
Like, it's one thing to give it to OG. It's another to go Gary Trent, Svi, Stanley Johnson. And like Gary Trent is obviously a player caliber that you don't really mind the player option, but on a pretty player friendly deal. So that the Raptors just do not care about the player option. Take it.
Yeah. Well, that's probably what Gary's going to be doing, or that's probably what Speed's going to be doing in the offseason, is taking that player option, because that's been the most successful year for him. But I mean, listen,
yeah, and
if
it's only
was your 12th
it's only
guy,
at the minimum.
I probably wouldn't mind.
Yeah, it's only at the minimum. So like, I get what they're thinking. It's that like, if anything other than a really bad season, he probably takes his chances, because like, his minimum in the offseason would actually be higher than his minimum on this thing, the way the raise system works. But also, like, is he getting a full year guaranteed from anyone after, like, if his season continues like this, where the shooting specialist is shooting 32% on threes for the third time in his 4-year career? I don't really know.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, look, listen, well, we saw Elijah Hughes, what he did with Utah. Like, I just feel like there has to be some kind of youngish player who can give you some better production at backup guard. Honestly, like, I'm not even trying to slander Malachi, but, like, even just watching some of these G League games, I'm like, there are guys who will play in that setting that will outperform. Not saying that that's what you're supposed to do, but obviously those are just individual kind of things, and I'm not watching all the G League games, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, the standard's just low, that's what I'm saying.
Lonnie Walker's an interesting one. Like that's an interesting name because he is expiring and you laid out a good case for it. You know, unfortunately, the reason a lot of bad teams are bad is that they don't have good point guard play. Like you open up the roster pages of some of the worst teams in the league and it's like, ooh, you taking a flyer on Corey Joseph return to just steady that backup point guard spot? Like, probably not. Like, I guess, though, I know the one guy that, and this is shooting much higher, but Eric Gordon has kind of played like a pseudo combo guard for Houston this year, and Houston would probably be thrilled to get out from under his money. He's got 2 years left, but I don't know that the Raptors want, you know, two extra years and $40 million of what'll then be a 34 and 35 year old Eric Gordon. So it's never surprising that bad teams don't have a lot of guys that you want to pry from there, but it is it's especially the case this year that the league's bad teams don't have, you know, there aren't a lot of DJ Augustines out there.
Wow. What a comp. Okay, all right.
Actual DJ Augustine is out there.
Oh, I'm sure he's evidently available. Like, he's got his bags packed, ready to go. All right, last thing before we go, I want to touch on Scottie's usage a little bit. So in this stretch here, his, you know, in the starting lineup with Scottie plus Gary plus OG plus Fred plus Pascal, clearly he's the guy who's the fifth option right now. His field goal attempts have dropped to 9.2 per game. The interesting thing is his touches are still fairly high when you look at, like, you know, Fred over the six-game win streak has had 93 touches per game, Pascal 81. Scottie's at 66, which is clearly the third in terms of just when you look at the tiers, because OG's next at 47, Gary's at 38, then Precious and Boucher, whatever, they're roughly in the 30s as well. So Scottie's still getting his touches, but he's not doing as much with the touches. I think maybe the knee thing, which he's questionable tonight, you know, is impacting this. Maybe that's the aggression. But, like, do you see a concern overall with, like, they're like, hey, you're Marc Gasol now? You know, is that worrying to you in any way? Or do you just see, like, bro, clearly Fred and Pascal are playing at elite levels. Gary and OG could do what they do. You're just going to have to sacrifice a little bit, Rook.
Yeah, I think that's more or less it, right? And I think it's part of why they've tried to give him the early hook in the rotation and get him back in there, because those are spots for him to handle the ball a little bit more and create a little bit more. And I thought, honestly, the last couple games, he just hasn't been super good, right? Like, are you really demanding shots for him in a game like New Orleans where he's 3 of 10 and has a couple iffy turnovers and stuff? I don't think so. And I don't think we're too, like, I thought that Spurs game was one of his best games of the season, even though he only took 7 field goal attempts. So I do think there's probably a belief that Scottie Barnes could be a really effective player without high usage. But I do think that this is the challenge of Nick Nurse and of kind of Fred and Pascal, because you don't want to control the offense as a duo to the extent that it freezes anyone out or stunts anyone else. And I don't think it's to that point yet, because again, Scottie's had some good games during this stretch, but I do think it's probably something that's on the radar. And in film sessions, it's like, hey, here's a chance to get Scottie going, or, you know, in semi-transition, especially if you can get him the ball while he's on the move, those are really advantageous spots for him to get, you know, like, let get him some easy buckets, right? Get him some second chances, get him some cuts, get him some transition opportunities, and those things add up quickly. And suddenly, you know, suddenly he's at 11 or 12 points instead of 6 or 7.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think, especially with the way that Fred's been getting trapped and doubled and stuff like that, I think the more they work on how to handle a guy getting blitzed, you know, how to short roll to make sure you're available for the catch, making a play in a 4-on-3 situation, that's going to help Scottie a lot in terms of, I just know he has that playmaking chop. I know that, you know, against a zone, for example, he can get into the middle of the zone and make a play from there. And the Raptors are seeing a fair bit of zone with how little shooting they're putting on the floor. So there's ways for Scottie to get involved. And I really do think that part of it is just that he's not feeling 100% with the knee. So that does it for us today. I'm your host, Will Liu, and you're listening to The Raptor Show on SportsNet590 The Fan. Make sure you find The Raptor Show wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe. And please rate and review our show. Thanks once again to Blake Murphy, to our board producer, Danielle Furtado, and we will talk to you tomorrow.